I'm sure I missed somebody. All right, we're in Daniel chapter 11. And last week there was a lot of names. So I went ahead and rewrote all those names back up there on this board as we kind of worked our way down through chapter 11. And if you missed last week and you missed some of the blanks, I've got the answer sheet so you can fill them in. But I just want to go a real quick review. The first couple of verses are dealing with Persia. We looked at all the various Persian kings, and of course we landed on Xerxes, who was the fellow who did invade Greece, tried to conquer Greece, and failed. Then we saw that in between verses 2 and 3, there was about 130 years that had elapsed, and then Alexander the Great came to power, and he went and conquered Persia as out of revenge more than anything. And we looked at a little bit of that. Then we, and this is really the key that I tried to bring up last week. When Alexander the Great died, his kingdom was divided up among four generals. And the two key generals that we want to remember is a fellow by the name of Ptolemy and another fellow by the name of Seleucus. And it's these two kingdoms, that the rest of the book of, well, most of the rest of the book, most of the rest of the Daniel chapter 11, that's terrible English. But a large portion of Daniel chapter 11 deals with these two houses that are warring for control over Palestine. Okay? And so we went down, and whenever you read King of the South, it's Egypt, or the house of Ptolemy. Whenever you read of the King of the North, it's Syria, or the household of Seleucus. Okay? And as we went down, I talked about some of the things that happened that Daniel 11:6 brings out in history. For example, with Ptolemy the Second Philadelphius, he got tired of the battling, got tired of the fighting and the warfare, so he wanted peace between the two houses. So he offered his sister, or no, not his sister, his daughter Bernice, to wed this fellow by the name of Antiochus Theos, which was a son of this fellow. But there was a condition, and that was that this man had to divorce his wife by the name of Laodicea and disown his two sons. So, yeah, you go, wow, but it happens. So not only did he offer his daughter as, as a peace child, but also he offered a big amount of money, large treasure. Well, Antiochus II, he thought, nah, that's a pretty good deal. I'm going to get a young bride out of the deal, and I'm going to get a lot of money out of the deal. So what does he do? He does. He divorces Laodicea. He disowns his two boys. And then as you go down through here, what happens is Bernice dies. Her father dies. Ptolemy dies. So Laodicea kills Bernice. Bernice, and her boy that these two had. And then she turns around and she poisons Antiochus. Okay? So she points, because she doesn't want to run that risk again. So she's going to, so she poisons her husband. And then he ends up dying. Well, Bernice's brother, Ptolemy III, Eurygetes, he steps up on the throne. And so out of revenge for what Laodicea does, he goes against Syria. And I put here blood feud, because from that point on, that's exactly what had happened. So no longer is it two households trying to, you know, gain control. It's now become a Hatfield-McCoy situation. It's turned into a blood feud. And then we talked about Seleucus Callinicus having two boys by the name of Seleucus Serenius and Antiochus III. And then Ptolemy Eurygetes, his boy comes into power, Ptolemy IV Philopater. Antiochus III tries to gain control over Palestine, but he's beaten by this guy here. In fact, he's beaten so bad that he almost completely defeats Antiochus III. But this guy here, he just doesn't have the stomach for warfare. In fact, he was kind of a dandy, okay? So he was more concerned about having, you know, a luxurious life. So he let him go, and he shouldn't have, but he let him go. So he goes back, he and his wife go back, and they live a very luxurious lifestyle. Well, because of his luxurious lifestyle, he passes away, his wife passes away, and his son, Ptolemy V, Epiphanes, he's only 4 years old, and so he's now sitting on the throne. He now is the king of the south. So this is where we're getting to now. So Antiochus III, who got whipped, he spent this time to rebuild his army. And so 12 years go by, and Antiochus III shows back up, and he's going to try to take Palestine, and he's going to even try to take Egypt. And that's where we're at in our study. That's kind of like the cliff notes, okay? Is that about right? Is that what I tried to convey last time we got together? So that's where we're at. So we are now looking at Daniel chapter 11. And we're going to start off here in Daniel 11, 13 to kind of bring it into some sort of context. So Daniel 11, 13. For we read, for the king of the north shall return. Okay, remember, the king of the north is Syria or the Seleucus household. So this king of the north that we're getting ready to talk about is this Antiochus III. So he's coming back. So Daniel 11, 13, for the king of the north shall return and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former. All right, so he's coming back with a bigger army. And shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches. So like I said, 12 years go by. During that 12-year period, he's off expanding his kingdom all the way to India. Okay, so he's busy. And so he's coming back with a massive army, because he's going to get revenge. Now in 2003 BC, and I think this is on your... Let me get that worksheet, because I want to make sure we stay on the worksheet. Okay. Yeah, down here at the bottom of page 20. No, I've got page 20. You probably don't have page 20. Down on the bottom of the page where there's that wreath, at victor's wreath. In 2003 BC, Ptolemy IV and his wife died, leaving their four-year-old son on the throne, Ptolemy V Epiphanes. So that's what goes into your blank. Ptolemy V Epiphanes. And so Antiochus III, having heard that Antiochus IV, who had defeated him and almost wiped him out, after he heard that this man had died, he thought his opportunity had come so that he could get the better out of the king of the south, or out of Egypt. So he thought this was the perfect time to attack Egypt. So having retooled, refinanced, and refurbished his forces, the king of the north, or this Antiochus III, or the Antiochus the Great, because he had visions of being another Alexander the Great. Right, so he was kind of a megalomaniac. He renewed his efforts to become the predominant power in the region. That's what he was all about. So 12 years after his defeat by Ptolemy IV, Antiochus the Great returned with a much larger and on your sheet there should be better equipped army than before. A better equipped army than before. Just like it says here in Daniel 11, 13, he shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches. And that's exactly what he did. Just like The angel showed Daniel. That's exactly what took place. So, as I said earlier, Antiochus had spent those years expanding his territory, building up his armies. And even at this time, he was even able to form an alliance with the king of Macedonia. So he was, he had a plan. He had a plan. Daniel 11:14, it says, "And in those times," speaking of when Antiochus and his army is marching to Egypt, right? "And in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south." This young man, Ptolemy, he's probably about 16 years of age at this time. "Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision," and I'll explain to you what that is in just a minute, "but they shall fall. So the many that shall stand up against the king of the south," there's three of the, it's kind of a threefold fulfillment. The first is, and this is your first blank, a revolt. A revolt had occurred in Egypt by those seeking to gain the throne from its young and inexperienced king. So that's your first thing. Jerome, who is a fellow who was famous in the Catholic Church years ago, he was involved with the Latin Vulgate. Anyway, Jerome wrote a commentary in defense of Daniel because there were those who were critical of Daniel, saying that Daniel wasn't a real book and, you know, it was made up. So Jerome was defending the book of Daniel, and in his research, he discovered that during this time when Antiochus III was getting ready to attack Egypt, because of this young king sitting on the throne, there were counselors that wanted to take the throne away from him. And so there was a revolt. They figured, you know, he's just a snot-nosed kid. What does he know? You know, I can run the show better than he can. So they were trying to take the throne away from this young man and try to become kings themselves. The second thing there on your sheet is that Antiochus and his larger army, coming from the north, his ally, the king of Macedonia, won Philip IV. And he was definitely a very real and present danger to this young king. And then it says here about the robbers of thy people. Now, according to Josephus, he tells of certain Jews. That's in your blank. Certain Jews of Jerusalem were secretly helping Antiochus III. They were secretly helping Antiochus III. Because they were tired of Egyptian rule. They were tired of the Ptolemy dynasty, and so they wanted a change of government. They wanted a change of government. So they began to support Antiochus III. Where it says there in Daniel 11:14, it says, "Exalt themselves to establish the vision." To exalt themselves, to establish the vision. What these Jews were doing was that they were operating from what they called a prophecy. They had prophets that were preaching to them that Antiochus III was going to overthrow Egypt to the Jews' advantage. So what they were doing, in order to win support for Antiochus III, these false prophets were preaching this false prophecy. Now, that has never happened in Israel's history before. No, it has. It was a big problem. My goodness, I got such a dry throat. If you look at Jeremiah, chapter 29, We're not going to go there, but it's interesting to read it because almost the whole chapter is dealing with various false prophets that were preaching to the people in Babylon and preaching to the people in Jerusalem, more or less telling them that the judgment of God was not going to fall on them, that there was going to be peace. What Jeremiah was telling them was a bunch of hooey, that it wasn't the truth, that what they were saying was the truth. So these false prophets, you know, they didn't like the idea of Jerusalem being conquered. They didn't like the idea of going into Babylonian captivity. So they were preaching contrary to what Jeremiah from God was telling Jerusalem. No, this is going to happen. This is going to happen. This is going to happen. Well, it's the same thing during this period of time with Antiochus Epiphanes, with these people who were exalting themselves to establish the vision in order to win over political support. They were trying to get sanction from Thus Saith the Lord. That doesn't happen today, does it? Sure it does. There's all sorts of people out there saying, trying to legitimize their ministry or legitimize their movement with the Thus Saith the Lord title on it. Believe me, just because it says it's Christian doesn't make it Christian. So based upon this spurious prophecy, that's a new word I learned, or this false prophecy, they began to rebel against the king of the south, and they began to support the king of the north, this Antiochus. And according to Daniel's prophecy, they would fail. And they did. They failed. They honestly believed, this is interesting, they honestly believed that they were ushering in an era of peace, and they were looking upon Antiochus as their savior. Kind of interesting, because that's going to be the mindset, I believe, of the Jews during the tribulation period. Because what are they going to want in the tribulation period? They're going to want peace, right? And somebody's going to come along and it's going to promise them this peace. So it's just kind of interesting how it just keeps repeating itself. What they don't realize is that when this household comes into power, they're going to bring in a fella who is called the Old Testament shadow of the Antichrist. And we'll talk about that when we get there. It's going to bring about a period of horrible persecution. So, the peace that they sought to buy for themselves is just not going to happen. It's not going to happen for Jerusalem. It's not going to happen for the land. So, that's what it means here by they shall fall. Daniel 11:15 says, "So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities. And the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand." So, short note, Antiochus III is going to become successful in his military conquests. Egypt, the king of the south, attempts to respond to the invasion of Antiochus III. But Antiochus is too strong for them, and he starts beating them back. And I think this is in your worksheet. A certain general by the name of Scopas, S-C-O-P-U-S, was ordered by Ptolemy V to lead his army to meet this threat. And the phrase there, cast up a mound, you know what that is, don't you? Whenever, in the olden days, whenever they would besiege a city, what would they do? They would surround the city with a mound. Right? That way they would keep anybody from escaping from the city and also keep anybody from trying to help the city. So it's kind of like a fortification around a fort. And that's exactly what Antiochus did. He built a mound around these fenced cities, and he was able to conquer these cities and these fortified towns. Now Antiochus defeated the Egyptian army led by General Scopas at the headwaters of the Jordan River. Okay, so that's in your sheet too. So Scopas was defeated at the headwaters of the Jordan River. And so what did he do? He retreated to a fortified city by the name of Sidon. And he and his 10,000 troops were laid siege to by Antiochus III, where he built the mound around the city. And three times the Egyptian army tried to go in there and try to free Scopas and his 10,000 besieged troops, but each time they failed. Each time they failed. And then Antiochus eventually took the city, and the king of the south lost control, and that's the next blank on your sheet, lost control of the glorious land. And that's, of course, that's what Israel is referred to in the book of Daniel, is the glorious land. Okay? Daniel 11:16 says, "But he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed." So just as Antiochus planned and what he wanted to accomplish, that's exactly what he did. He defeated Egypt, he pushed them out of the promised land, and now, for the first time, the household of Seleucus, or the king of the north, has full control of the promised land. The phrase, "which by his hand shall be consumed," there in verse 16 simply means that Israel is now under control. And in fact, it would remain under control of the king of the north all the way up until the Maccabees kick him out. So for now on, the Seleucus household will have control. And then, of course, the Maccabean revolt will happen. And then the Hasmonean dynasty, where Herod and those guys came from, they'll come into power. And then finally, Rome will take over. Daniel 11:17, it says, "He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him." So he's marching in, he's coming, and he's going to want to take over Egypt. So he's bringing his whole strength, his whole military might, onto Egypt to try to take him over. And unlike Ptolemy IV, who just didn't have the stomach for it, who didn't capitalize on his opportunity to defeat this household of Seleucus, he was determined, and that's in your sheet. Antiochus was determined to overthrow Ptolemy V Epiphanes to gain control of Egypt, because Antiochus had aspirations of being the next Alexander the Great. So he was wanting to completely control Egypt. That was his intention. But he didn't march straight into Egypt. He didn't really want to take on a campaign like that. So what he tried to do is he tried to conquer Egypt diplomatically. Diplomatically. And historians believe that the reason why Antiochus didn't march into Egypt militarily and tried the backdoor diplomacy is because the next world power was beginning to stretch its muscle. And what is that next world power on the scene? Rome. So that's the reason why Antiochus III didn't try to take over Egypt militarily, because Egypt and Rome started to talk to one another and started to have these friendly trade agreements and alliances. So Antiochus III wasn't quite ready to take on the up-and-coming power of Rome. So He tried diplomacy. You know, he captured a number of cities, but when he came to Egypt, he discovered that Rome was there, and so he thought differently. He says, "No, I'm not going to do this." So what does he do? So he seeks to make peace. So due to Rome's powerful support of Egypt, Antiochus III indicated his willingness to make peace with Ptolemy V and to have his daughter, Cleopatra, to become Ptolemy V's wife. And we've heard of Cleopatra. And yes, it is the Cleopatra that we have heard of. So Cleopatra is the daughter of this Antiochus III from the house of Seleucid, the king of the north. He was an ambitious man, and he was no dummy. He did not want to tangle with Rome's military might, but at the same time, he still did not want to give up his desire to control Egypt. And so he offered his daughter Cleopatra to be the wife of Ptolemy V, and so they both got married. And Ptolemy V was now about 16, 17 years of age at the time, and Cleopatra, guess how old she was? 10 years of age. Yeah. Pretty wild, isn't it? So, Antiochus' scheme, that's it, Antiochus' scheme was to use his daughter Cleopatra to eventually gain control of the Egyptian territory. I mean, what is it they say? The man is the head of the house, but the woman is the neck, and wherever the... Well, anyway. He was hoping, right, to have influence in Egyptian policy through his daughter Cleopatra. That was his scheme. That was what he was hoping. That's what it means here. In verse 17, he shall give him the daughter of women. You know, that's a highfalutin way of saying that she's the daughter of the king, corrupting her. And to corrupt means to use her as a means to introduce policies favorable to himself. So he was going to use Cleopatra to try to influence policy and corrupt the government in Egypt that would be favorable to him. That was his plan. But his scheme backfired because it says here in the verse that she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. So I think in your worksheet it says Cleopatra, being a young and impressionable girl, proved to be more faithful to her husband than her father. Right? 10 years old. She's with this young man, 16-year-old. Naturally, she's going to become infatuated, in love with him, and she's going to ignore what dad is trying to tell her. I mean, isn't that just true to life? Sure it is. Sure it is. That is so true to life. So that's exactly what happens. He was hoping to be able to influence the government there in Egypt, but ends up backfiring, blowing up in his face. And Cleopatra becomes, of course, eventually a very, very key player and all of that politics, like, you know, you hear Mark Antony. If you're familiar with the Shakespeare or anything like that, she had a big part in all of that. Well, that's where she came from. That's where she came from. Daniel 11:18 goes on and says, after this shall he turn his face unto the isles and shall take many. But a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach, he shall cause it to turn upon him. So Antiochus III, even though he's stymied in his plans for Egypt, he was not finished in expanding his kingdom. So what does he do? He begins to, it says here that he begins to face onto the isles, which means he starts looking out upon his horizons and says, okay, what can I conquer? So he starts conquering Asia Minor or Turkey. He crosses over that little strip of water into Greece, starts conquering the Greek Isles, starts conquering Greece. He gets as far as almost to the city of Corinth. Almost to the city of Corinth in his conquests. And finally, he runs into somebody that stops his expansion efforts. And again, he runs into Rome. He runs into Rome. Antiochus's expansion plans are halted. He's unable to conquer any more territory, for he ran into the rising Roman Empire, is your next blank on your sheet there. And he's defeated at a place called Thermopylae. Thermopylae. What What was the name of that movie? The 300? That's the very place that he was defeated, where King Leo stopped the Persian army long enough for the Greek navy to defeat the Persian navy and stopped Xerxes from, or stopped the Persians from conquering Greece. That was the very same place that the Romans stopped Antiochus III. And he had to retreat finally into a city by the name of Ephesus. The Romans were getting tired of Antiochus meddling around and trying to conquer all of their territory when they're interested in the very same territory. And so they started to deal with Antiochus. They started to focus on him more intently. And in 190 B.C., I know this is just history, but in 190 B.C., Antiochus and his force of 80,000 troops were defeated by Rome, by the name of a general by the name of Scipio. And I know that probably doesn't mean anything to anybody, but it's just something that I thought was fascinating, just something that I found when I was studying it. That's what it means by, but a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. In other words, Antiochus' expansion stopped. Rome put a stop to it. Rome put a stop to it. And on your sheet there, after his defeat, Rome, after his defeat by Rome, this Roman general named Scipio placed a heavy settlement upon Antiochus, a heavy settlement. And what that simply means is this, is that Antiochus had to pay Rome a tax, a heavy, heavy tax. Also, he had to surrender his friend Hannibal of the elephants to the Romans. So, you know, there's some interesting names there. He also had to give the Rome 20 choice hostages so that Antiochus would behave himself. And one of these hostages is his son, which we're going to look at here pretty soon, by the name of Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. So that's where Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes shows up. He spends some time in Rome as a guest of Rome. Daniel 11:19 says, "Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land. But he, speaking of Antiochus the Third, he shall stumble and fall and not be found." So this settlement that was placed upon Antiochus, well, Rome had a reason for it. And this reason is very simple. They wanted to economically cripple Antiochus the Third. If he didn't have any money, he couldn't pay his troops, right? So that's what they set out to do. They wanted to economically cripple Antiochus so he could not raise up another army. And so Antiochus still had to keep he still had to get this money. He had to get this money from somewhere, right? He had to get this money from somewhere. So where does he get it? In your worksheet, in order to pay the heavy settlement, Antiochus went about robbing from wealthy temples within his kingdom. That's what he did. He went around to all these temples and he started stripping of gold and silver and all the precious stones in order to pay Rome's settlement. And it says here in this passage, "But he shall stumble and fall and not be found." Well, while plundering a wealthy temple in one of the cities, the city of Elymais, the citizens got upset. And they rebelled. And what do? They lynch Antiochus the Third. They kill him. They kill him. So that's what it means by he shall stumble and fall and not be found. So as far as Antiochus the Great is concerned, he robbed his last temple. And the people killed him in outrage. In outrage. Daniel 11:20 reads, "Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom, but within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle." So Antiochus III had these two boys, Antiochus Epiphanes, that we're going to look at here a little later. But he had another boy by the name of say Lucius Philopater. I don't know if that means lover or father or what, but Philopater is his name. And that'll be on your sheet. Seleucus Philopater is one of the two sons of Antiochus the Great. And he's the one who took over the throne from Daddy when Daddy was killed by the outraged citizens. And what this guy did was he started raising taxes. He started raising taxes. Due to the heavy tribute and growing power and influence of Rome, this Seleucus Philopater was forced to raise oppressive taxes on the Jewish people. A man by the name of Heliodorus, he was a tax collector of this Seleucus Philopater. He would end up robbing the Jewish temple. That's on your worksheet. He would rob the Jewish temple in Jerusalem of its treasures. Well, the reason why this Heliodorus is so important is because Heliodorus poisoned Seleucus Philopater. He poisoned him, killed him. I mean, that's just what you did back then, I guess. And that's what it means in the passage up here in that he shall, but within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. All right, so in other words, he was poisoned. So Seleucus Philopater was assassinated by his tax collector. And what that did was, is that opened up the door for his brother, Antiochus the IV Epiphanes. Antiochus the IV Epiphanes. And he was currently in Rome. And I think that's the last thing on your sheet. It was this treacherous act of assassination that would open the way for Antiochus the IV. Whoops, sorry about that. Epiphanes. Okay? So that closed out that sheet. So we'll start on a new sheet. So if you'll just grab one and hand it back. So now, we're going to look at Antiochus Epiphanes, the IV, with a little more detail than what we have in the past. And this man's life or career begins here in verse 20 and goes all the way to verse 35 in Daniel chapter 11. Okay. So as you begin to read here, starting in verse 20 and going down to these passages, or going down to these verses, it's almost like all of this that has taken place has led up to this man's reign, this man's career. Remember a while back I was telling you about the prophecy in Daniel, how it's kind of like taking a magnifying microscope and you just keep dialing down, getting closer and closer and closer until you see the deadly virus. That's the deadly virus. We're going to get ready to look at this deadly virus. Because this man here will be the biggest threat to the Jews in a long, long time. Bigger than even Pharaoh was in Egypt. He's going to be a huge threat. Bigger than Then Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon, he's a huge threat. So there are some things here that we want to look at. Before we get too deep, let me find my cheat sheet. First thing that you want to take note of, as we get closer and closer to Antiochus Epiphanes in the second century, as I said before, this guy is kind of is a shadow of the Antichrist to come. And if you look, and the reason why I go through all this history that Daniel is laying out here, remember, this is still future to Daniel. And as we get to this man, what we're going to see is we're going to see a lot of similarities with the history behind this man as he rises to power, which I believe will be indicative of when the Antichrist shows up. And I'll show you that in just a minute. So as we get closer and closer to the Antichrist, just as they were getting closer and closer to this fella, you're going to see some things. The first thing on your sheet there, these were days of conflict. These were days of conflict. Remember, these two households have been fighting over this piece of ground because of its strategic location. So these were days of conflict for the nation of Israel. The land of Jews was caught in this vice grip of superpowers battling with superpowers, each one trying to gain control over this little piece of real estate. Constant warfare was sweeping back and forth across this region for hundreds of years, hundreds of years. I took the time one time a long time ago, and I found that the Bible records 80 battles, at least 8 civil wars, 4 major invasions by superpowers, and then numerous smaller invasions like, you know, little tribes or people showing up. So there's a lot of constant warfare over that little piece of ground. A lot of constant warfare over that little piece of ground. And now we have this incessant, constant warfare between these two houses of Ptolemy and Seleucid. And so as far as years of peace are concerned, there were very few years of peace with Israel. I think they enjoyed some peace with Solomon. They enjoyed a little peace, not much with David. There were just little brief periods of peace, but all in all, that's a very contested piece of ground. It's not like that today, though, is it? Yeah, it is. Very much so. So it's, what did that Bible say? Nothing new under the sun, right? It's still a very contested piece of ground. In fact, the Lord Jesus Christ, in speaking of the last days, this is what he said in Matthew 24:6. He says, "And ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet." So that little strip of ground is probably the most contested piece of real estate on this planet. That would be my guess. I also got online, and I was just kind of curious. But since Israel became a nation in 1948... she has already fought 7 major wars. 7 major wars. She's been involved in numerous conflicts. Even today, she's surrounded by enemies. I mean, she is a nation under siege. She's surrounded by enemies. She's always alert for the next attack. Anybody that I've ever talked to who's gone to Israel or Jerusalem to visit, one of the things they notice is the armed soldiers that patrol the streets everywhere. They're everywhere because that nation is a nation under siege. She has a lot of enemies seeking her destruction. If you read the news, if you pay attention, she's still in the middle of conflict. She's still a nation that is debated over, a nation that is constantly in the target of the Gentile nations that are treading over her. I mean, just recently, President Trump was going to, he's going to move our, in fact, he has, hasn't he? Move our embassy into Jerusalem. The world loved that, didn't it? So, well, that's a good idea. We all ought to do it. No. So since its inception, modern day Israel has enjoyed, I don't think, a single year of peace. Since 1948. Yes, Ron.
I heard a story, I don't know if it's true or not, but did they constantly have several islands that they controlled and in cockpits of airplanes on the runway at idle, ready to take off at a second notice?
Yeah, I believe that's true. Yeah, they're always on that. If they're not on high alert, they're on the verge of high alert all the time. Yeah, I think there's some truth to that. So that's the first thing. So it's days of conflict. So the second thing on your sheet, the land of Daniel's people was in the eye of the storm, right? So when all of this was going on with the death of Antiochus and Seleucus Philopater and all this struggling going on, they were people in the eye of the storm. If you stop and think about it, that's just a little piece of ground, isn't it? And the Jews, you know, they're not, you wouldn't think anything about the Jews too much, but they always find themselves in the epicenter of dispute between nations. Always. Always. Back in those times, it was a strategic land bridge. It was a very strategic piece of ground. It's still a very strategic place. Always a point of contention. Like I mentioned in 2018, what did the Palestinians do when Trump said that he was moving our embassy to Jerusalem? Did they take it peacefully? No, they did not, did they? No. To say that they were very upset would be an understatement. You know, a lot of folks, I'm going to get a little political here. A lot of folks think that radical Islam is a new thing on the scene. No, it's not. Radical Islam is not new on the scene. It's been around since Islam has been here. And there's always been this enmity between Israel and the Arab peoples. Now, I wonder why that is. Could it be with Ishmael and Isaac, maybe? I don't know. Yes, I do. It's a continuation of feud that just dates back centuries and centuries and centuries. Eli Weissel, Nobel Prize winner, founding chairman of the United States Holocaust Memorial Council. He also himself is a Holocaust survivor. He's got the tattoo on his arm. This is what he said about his people being in the eye of the storm. This is a speech he gave one time before the United Nations. He says, the enemy can afford losing once, three times, 10 times. For us, no victory would be final, while any defeat would be the last. And I think that pretty well summarizes where Israel is. Her enemies would be satisfied with nothing less than what? Total annihilation. Total annihilation. That's what Iran is screaming about all the time. Total annihilation. You can find this in your archives on March 13th, 2018. An article in a Turkish paper quoted Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdoğan. I know I butchered his name.
I think it's Erdoğan.
Thank you. This is what he said. He wants to form an army of Islam to attack and destroy the state of Israel. That's what he wants to form. He wants to call all 57 members of the Organization of Islamic Corporation to join forces against the Israeli occupiers. They would vastly be outnumbered. They would be unable to defend their country. And according to the president of Turkey, he says that we could defeat Israel militarily in 10 days and diplomatically in 20 days, thereby liberating Palestine. So that's their thinking. That's what they want to do. They're looking at kicking the Jews out as liberating Palestine. Liberating Palestine. Sure he would. Sure he would. So Israel, as it was back here in the second century, being in the eye of the storm, Israel is still in the eyes of the storm. And then number three, Daniel's people, the Jews, in the context of political and military events of the times. Political and military events of the times. They were always in the center of this struggle between these two kings, the king of the south and the king of the north. They were pawns, I guess, in these two houses' game of wanting to control. It's not any different today with Israel. Israel finds herself in the same place in the context of military and political wranglings in the world. Just using the recent event of Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, moving the U.S. embassy there. I looked this up because I was just kind of curious, you know, how the U.N. General Assembly voted for this. And the vote in the U.N. Assembly was this: 128 against and 9 for the United States. With 35 nations abstaining. So the majority of the United Nations voted against the United States in recognizing Jerusalem as the capital. 198 nations. And 35 of those nations abstained. So to me, an abstention is the same thing. Pretty much the same thing. So just like back in here, and this time in the context when Antiochus Epiphanes is getting ready to rise up upon the scene, Israel is there in that same old position of that military and that political tension going on between these two forces. And just as the world was for the Jews back when Antiochus Epiphanes came to power, I think the Jews are going to find themselves in the very same place when the Antichrist finally comes to power. So what we're going to look at here, starting in verse 21, is what I believe is history's most explicit prototype of the Antichrist yet to come. In this person, Antiochus Epiphanes. In Daniel 11:21, we read, "And in his estate shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries." That sounds really familiar, doesn't it? It really does. But we're talking about a man who lived back here, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago, before Christ was even born. And it's interesting to me that the angel speaking to Daniel calls this individual a vile person. A vile person. Now, the word estate means throne, the throne of Antiochus the Great. He had died, right? And so, at the hands of an outraged mob. And so in his estate, in Antiochus III's estate, this vile person is going to stand up. And Antiochus III is the son of this Antiochus Epiphanes is also the son of Antiochus III. He's the guy that went to Rome, right, to try to keep Antiochus III to behave himself. And so he was a hostage in Rome. Now, Daniel is informed that a vile person who has no right to obtain the throne will do just that. He'll fill the office of the king that he rightly does not belong to. Now, there's another fella. Let me see here. Yeah. King Seleucus IV had a son named Demetrius, who was the rightful heir. So after Heliodorus poisoned Seleucus Philopater, this Demetrius is the next one to step into line. He was the one who was going to step in for the throne, but Antiochus steps in and takes the throne away from his brother Demetrius. He took it from Demetrius. Now, Antiochus the Great, we've already been introduced to him. He's the fellow in Daniel 8:9. He's the little horn, right? He's that little horn that in Daniel 8:9, and out of one of them came forth a little horn which waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land. That's this Antiochus Epiphanes. This vile person mentioned here in Daniel 11:21. Now, Antiochus Epiphanes reigned from 175 B.C. to 165 B.C. So that's 10 years, isn't it? Yeah, it's about 10 years. And he sprouted from one of the horns from from the house of the Seleucid. Yeah, if you remember Daniel 11:5, it says, "And the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him, and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion." That's that king of the north. Well, this is where Antiochus Epiphanes comes from. Okay, I'm going to have to skip some of this because I'm running out of time. Okay, so King Seleucus IV had a son named Demetrius, who was the rightful heir. And we were talking about this vile person. So Antiochus seized the throne for himself with the help of a man by the name of King Eumenes II of Pergamon. And he claimed the throne. Now, here's a little bit of history. This kind of shows you this guy. It says here in the history book, Seleucus's legitimate heir, Demetrius I, was a hostage in Rome. So Antiochus seized the throne for himself with the help of King Eumenes II of Pergamon, proclaiming himself co-regent with another son of Seleucus, an infant named Antiochus, whom Antiochus would murder a few years later. So this Antiochus IV, this vile person, he had a little brother that he would kill in order to get on the throne. So he was a nice guy. A Roman historian, wrote about Antiochus IV. And this Roman historian who was familiar with this man, this is what he writes about Antiochus IV, which kind of fits the vile person that the Bible describes him. He says, Antiochus IV was a compound of everything that was absurd and trifling. Nothing was more vile and contemptible than the king himself. So that's a historian of that time. Of course, this ancient Roman historian didn't know what Daniel's book said about the man, but it's just kind of interesting that history kind of goes right along. Well, you know how that works, don't you? This historian also talks about the indiscretions and follies of this man so much that he writes, such perversity and indiscretion prevailed in his whole conduct and behavior that they soon changed the surname Epiphanes, like God or godlike, to Epimenes, which means madman or crazy one. So that's kind of a play on word. For many were the acts of his folly and madness which he committed. So he's kind of off his rocker. Another historian writes that Antiochus Epiphanes was a strange combination of genius and degenerate. He was reckless, possessed of a degree of self-confidence amounting to megalomania, ambitious yet short-sighted, deficient in self-control and mental balance, without the power to react in the presence of adversity. Sounds like a nice guy. Sounds like somebody would be a good president. In 2 Maccabees chapter 9, and all of this is in description of this vile person, 2 Maccabees 9:8 writes, "And he but now supposed himself to have the waves of the sea at his bidding, so vainglorious was he beyond the condition of man, that thought to weigh the heights of the mountains in a balance." So in other words, he thought that he could control the waves of the sea, and that his thinking was way beyond the mountain peaks. That was his opinion of himself. Now listen to Paul's prophetic description of the coming Antichrist. 2 Thessalonians 2:4, "Who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God." So just as Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes was a megalomaniac, such will be the Antichrist to come. An ego beyond belief. Antiochus the Fourth, his own personal ambition, he also wanted to be compared to Alexander the Great. What is that? Napoleonic complex? Is that what it is? That's what he had. He had an Alexandrian complex. It says here in Daniel, "To whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries." So this throne was not meant for Antiochus. It was meant for Demetrius. But he kind of got in there and finagled it around. At the death of Heliodorus, the tax collector, Antiochus the Fourth stepped up and claimed the crown for himself. And what he did was he started, what is that phrase, greasing palms, bribing. He started bribing some folks. He started promising this king of Pergamon, you know, fabulous wealth. He smooth-talked some Roman officials, all for the purpose of gaining the throne. It says here, "Obtained the kingdom by flatteries." He flattered these kings. He flattered the Romans to get there. He used bribery, flattery, whatever it took, whatever it took. He was a good politician. He was a good politician. Daniel 11:21, it says, "He shall come in peaceably." Is in reference to this region experiencing a cessation of hostilities. That's also on your worksheet. Between these two households. So just like the Antichrist in the future that will come in peaceably, so did this Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. He would come in peaceably. And I think we're going to stop with this one right here. So he came in, and in actuality, when Antiochus III pushed Egypt out of the promised land, he, because the Jews assisted him, he gave the Jews a certain amount of liberty to go ahead and practice their religion and just run their own everyday lives. So they had a certain amount of liberty under Antiochus III's reign. They also had a certain level of peace under this man's reign. So when he comes into power, all he's doing is inheriting what his daddy had already set up for him. All he had to do was flatter a few folks and grease a few palms and kill an infant brother in order to get onto the throne. So he was indeed a vile person. And I think we're going to stop right there. So any questions on anything that we covered? Okay. And if anybody needs to fill in their blanks, I've got that sheet. If they want to do that, you can borrow that. I know it's a lot of history, a lot of names, but it's all prophesied and been fulfilled. And we're going to look at Antiochus Epiphanes in a little more detail. And as we study this man's life, I believe he provides some insight in the up-and-coming Antichrist and some insight into that period of time that this world's getting ready to experience. Okay? All right, so go ahead and close out in prayer, and then we will be dismissed. Father in heaven,